Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We have some stories of American workers. That's what we showcase once again today. Dock workers on the West Coast and women in the workforce facing very different changes in the U.S. economy. That's later this hour. And Silent Night, an Austrian pop hit from 1818, still making the charts. But we begin by looking at a strategically targeted attack by the Taliban in Pakistan that has simultaneously struck two crucial institutions, the military and schools. An army-run school was attacked by Taliban commandos who opened fire on students, taking some as hostages. There was a bombing as well. Dozens of military personnel were injured or killed, but the bloody attack most tragically killed schoolchildren as young as 12 years old. The Taliban has taken responsibility for this attack, saying it was in response to an offensive carried out by the Pakistani military back in June that cleared out many of the Taliban's hideouts in North Waziristan. But this carnage underscores the growing chaos in Peshawar and what has been called the jihadi machine, which has an increasingly tight lock on large parts of Pakistan. Speaking from London today, Secretary of State John Kerry condemned the attack.
The attacks in Peshawar and Sydney underscore that threats locally are also threats globally. In today's world, next door is everywhere.
Secretary of State John Kerry, what can the U.S. do to support Pakistan right now, especially as the government, the military, and the Pakistani intelligence services seem to have very different views on how to deal with the various jihadi groups operating in Pakistan? Joining us now is Declan Walsh, Pakistan reporter for our partner, The New York Times, speaking to us from London. Welcome, Declan.
Hello.
So what can the U.S. do here? How unprecedented is this attack, and does it open a new era?
Well, this is one of the worst Taliban attacks, Pakistani Taliban attacks in years in Pakistan. There have been other attacks that have killed certainly over 100 people over the years. But really, this is the first time that the militants have stormed into a school and killed so many children in this way. So it has brought waves of revulsion and shock across Pakistan and certainly across the world. Only last week, we had a young woman from the same part of Pakistan, Malala Yousafzai, who was given the Nobel Peace Prize for her work in campaigning for the rights of children to education. You'll remember that she herself had been shot by the Taliban some years ago. And here we have the Taliban giving this, in a sense, a response that states very unambiguously that they're able to continue their attacks and that they're unafraid of striking even the most vulnerable civilian targets. In terms of the US, Pakistan and the US, after a very difficult number of years, particularly following the US commando raid to kill Osama bin Laden, have actually been on a fairly even path for the last 6 or 8 months. Relations have been gradually improving. There had long been criticisms of the Pakistan army that it had an ambiguous approach towards Islamist militancy and that that was hampering the country's ability to deal with its own militant problem. The army launched an operation against the Taliban in North Waziristan. That's in the tribal belts along the Afghan border last June. That operation is continuing. The army says it's killed 2,000 people. And the Taliban, in claiming responsibility for today's atrocity, has painted it as an act of retribution for that. It says that it is striking at the army and at the state, at mainstream Pakistani society more generally, as a response to the North Waziristan operation.
Is the Taliban the only jihadi story in the Peshawar region, or are they just leading a pack of growing insurgencies?
Well, the Pakistani Taliban are certainly the dominant force in the Peshawar area. There are other militant groups along the border that have different agendas, and some of them have been carrying out attacks inside Afghanistan, using Pakistani territory to conduct cross-border raids. That's been the main source of contention with the United States and with the neighboring government in Afghanistan. And across Pakistan, of course, there are other militant groups, some of which are engaged in sectarian violence against minorities, others which have carried out attacks in neighboring India. That's really where much of the criticism until now has been leveled against the Pakistan government. Critics say that while the military has been fighting very hard against the Pakistani Taliban, it has shirked the fight against other groups which it may have some sympathy with or indeed may even be supporting, such as the militants who carry out attacks in India, and that that has hampered their ability to cut down on the on militant attacks inside the country. But really, you know, it remains to be seen now what impact this particular attack will have domestically in Pakistan, because of the scale of the attack and also because of the nature of the target. Education is something that, you know, even in the poorest Pakistani families, people prize very dearly. And I think the images that are coming out, the very emotional images of, you know, parents rushing to the school and children who've been killed being carried away from the scene of this attack, will at least in the short term, I think, have quite a strong impact inside Pakistan.
Declan Walsh is Pakistan reporter for our partner, The New York Times. He spoke with us from London. Thank you so much, Declan.
Thank you.
Later this hour, we will look at some deep shifts going on in the American workforce for women. But this next story is a scene out of a macho Hollywood drama about dock workers and the ancient power of the big ships that haul the goods of the world.
You want to know what's wrong with our waterfront? It's the love of a lousy buck. It's making love of a buck, the cushy job, more important than the love of man.
On the Waterfront, the movie with Carl Malden and Marlon Brando, tells the story of the workers' triumph over the mob. Today, the battle on the docks is worker versus machine. And in the shadow of Hollywood, the machines are winning on the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach.
It was just unbelievable watching a terminal work with almost no noise and no visible people. Everything was driverless. I mean, we were all like looking at each other like, oh, my God, scared as hell.
That's James Spinner Spinoza, former president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, or the ILWU. In day two of independent producer Lou Olkowski's series Cargoland, a collaboration with KCRW, we learn that all is not well on the waterfronts of the West Coast.
It is this thing that everyone says they won't talk about, but it's all they're talking about. And everyone gets the sense that they're not supposed to be talking about it. Does the union want me to talk about it? But it is a number one thing that is on everyone's mind, because the job of moving cargo, you know, was traditionally done with lots and lots of human beings. At first, in the old days, it was human beings physically lifting things. And now it's people driving, you know, trucks and cranes to move this cargo around. But what's going to happen with automation is that many of those people are not going to be needed at all.
And the people who love to talk about this are the economists, who don't necessarily have a dog in the fight, but can certainly see what's happening. Here's Walter Kemsies, who's chief economist at Moffitt and Nichols.
How can you run that much volume through that small space? You're not going to do it with human beings. Human beings can't run around and move that. They're neither physically capable of working that hard and that much, but it's also really, really dangerous. There's a scale of activity beyond which it is not safe for human beings to be involved.
But boy, the human beings definitely want to be involved, and they've already experienced some level of automation over the last 3 decades. What do they say about it?
They don't want to give up. They do not want to give up at all. You know, they worry about job loss. They worry, they think, oh, my father, my grandfather worked on the docks, and these are great, great jobs. And like, I want my family, my kids to be able to have this job, and they want it to exist, you know? Walter Kemsies would just think these jobs are going to go away, and there are going to be other jobs that open up doing other kinds of things related to longshore work, and just don't worry about it.
Yeah, well, it's easy, course, it's easy to say, but when you talk to someone like Gretchen Williams, who's a supercargo for Matson Navigation, you know, to talk to her, it's like she's showing you her family photo album.
My stepdad, he developed the Lines Bureau in the 50s, and he was ILWU for 47 years when he retired. So I'm third generation. I think that my family has bridged the golden age of longshoring, because now we're being eliminated by technology, essentially. Mine is the last generation that will have a lifetime job.
What did her face look like when she told you that?
Well, she loves the waterfront. But I don't think she's holding on to it. You know, she's retiring quite soon. And there's a sadness, you know, but she's so tough. Gretchen is one of the first women to work at the port, and that came with a fight. And so this, it's another fight.
So who is fighting this automation? Who's trying to stand firm in the face of all this change?
Well, holding on to every job you can hold on to is a battle. You know, the men and women who run the ILWU are so smart in how they have protected work for their union members. You know, one of the people I met was part of the leadership, you know, several years ago when automation first came on the scene. This guy, James Spinoza, Spinner, under his leadership, they basically outbid another union to take mechanics work away from the mechanics union and make it, if it was on the port, an ILWU job. So they basically stole work from another union. But then they did something crazy. When computers were first coming in for the clerks, they kind of knew that, you know, this was automation on a smaller level, right? And Spinner thought, that could be a union job. And so here's this guy who's president of the union who starts going in to like 12, 16 different companies, finding the people who do that specific job function, learning the ins and outs of the loopholes of how they do the job, asking those people to turn and leave the employer and go join the union if he can get these jobs for them. And then going through, I believe it's the National Labor Relations Board, to then classify these jobs as union in a huge lawsuit. Can you just imagine sneaking in to like 14 different companies, stealing workers from management to make them union workers, to hold on to jobs for your men and women? They battle for every single job. It is unbelievable.
The traditional jobs of handling cargo are going to disappear. This is not an official report, but what I've been told, when Middle Harbor opens up for the port of Long Beach, that they could lose almost 50% of their man hours. That's half the work of Long Beach. It's coming too fast. You know, that's tremendous, a short period of time to get rid of thousands of workers when you're not dealing with it. You know, it's not going to be easy, and there's going to be some pain here, without a doubt. How much, we'll see, but definitely going to be some pain here.
Pain, of course, means layoffs.
Yeah, no work means lack of work, for sure.
What do you think the port of Long Beach and the port of Los Angeles will look like in 20 years if someone were to venture back and redo this series in a generation?
I think there may be obviously more automated terminals, unlike the terminals now where there's lots of people and a lot of noises. The automated terminals are really unusually quiet. But even though automation is going to happen, I think where people like Kemsies are seeing the opportunity is in exports. You know, everything we've been talking about, moving containers, moving boxes, that's about importing. That's about bringing things here to us. And Kemsies is a big believer that, you know, America, we do have things to ship to the rest of the world. You know what we're great at? We're great at food. We are great at growing things. We are great at beef. We are great at wheat. And like, we need to build an infrastructure to move more of that out. And so I'm not sure what that looks like, because that doesn't sound as quiet, right, as an automated terminal only bringing in boxes. And I think if the country does move to work on those exports, I think it can still sound really noisy out there. There could still be a lot of work out there.
Lou Elkowski produced Cargoland in partnership with KCRW. She's now a producer and reporter with our friends at WGBH in Boston.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
On Monday, we took note of the fact that the biggest trend in the American workforce since 1999 has been the growth of people who have left the workforce altogether. We looked at the reasons for male workers' non-participation in the labor force and where they go when they leave. Today, Claire Kane Miller, reporter for Upshot, a New York Times website covering policy and everyday life, looks at the very different situation for women. Women's revolutionary gains in the 20th century workforce have been stalled by a lack of foresight and policies to help families.
The workforce participation of men has been declining steadily for many, many decades. For women, meanwhile, it had been climbing very steeply since the 70s. It had been climbing since the 40s when more women entered the workforce when men were away during World War II. But in the 70s, it really started to climb during the feminist revolution and climbed considerably all the way until 1999. And at that point, it just stopped. It started plateauing and for many groups of women actually declining. And that has been one of the biggest mysteries to economists to look at this, particularly because in other wealthy countries, including many countries in Europe, it has continued to increase during that time.
Is there an event that explains the plateau? Is there a divergence in the population of groups of women, some of which are declining, some of which continue to rise, that sort of gets into the details of this plateauing?
The workforce participation hasn't really continued to rise for any group of women, but it has declined much more steeply for women without significant education and women who work in low-income jobs. And that really reflects what's also been happening for men, which is that the American economy right now is a much easier place to be if you have education, and you are much more likely to be able to find a job if you're highly educated. But what has been different for women than men, and what has been different between the United States and some countries in Europe in that period of time, is that there have been basically no policies at the federal level and in many workplaces that help women balance career and family. And meanwhile, in Europe, they have added so many policies like that and expanded their policies. I'm talking about things like parental leave and subsidized childcare. And that really points to a lot of the difference between what's happened with women in the United States and elsewhere since the beginning of this century.
So statistically, it seems like we're seeing a rise in workforce participation by women that can be explained by the abatement of raw discrimination over gender issues. But then once you get to the end of the 20th century, the weight of not having any compensatory benefit programs deal with some of these work career issues, that begins to drag on the workforce participation, and you see women choosing to really avoid the dilemmas that are caused by not having the same benefit packages that exist elsewhere.
That's right. The 70s were a time of such change. Women started controlling their reproduction, which means that they didn't have to stay home with kids until they decided to have kids. They were marrying later. They were divorcing more often. They were getting college degrees. And all of this meant, and like you said, discrimination was subsiding. And all of this meant that women were entering the workforce in really large numbers. And then what happened in the United States is basically it all stopped. There have been no federal policies since 1993 that address anything about people who have responsibilities for childcare outside of the office. And a lot of my readers have said, don't men have children too? Why is this not about men? Exactly. But in our culture and in most American families, the brunt of the burden for childcare and housework still falls upon women. And, you know, single parents are more likely to be mothers. And so that's why this is a women's issue that we're talking about.
Who represents this sort of frustration plateau that you've outlined in your piece?
Well, one of the women in my piece is named Carrie Devine, and she lives in right outside Seattle, Washington. But she grew up in England, and she said that all her friends in the United States, like her, quit their jobs when they had kids. All her friends in Europe, though, are still working after they had kids. And she basically said she got 12 weeks of maternity leave, and she just could not leave a 12-week-old in daycare. But in England, where she grew up, they get a year of maternity leave and it's almost all paid. She said if she'd had a year, she would still be in the workforce today. I do want to point out that this is not the classic story we hear about highly educated women leaving work who have the luxury, who have maybe husbands who make a lot of money, who, you know, people have called it the opt-out revolution. This is much more of an issue among lower income and working class people, people who are single mothers, people who just don't make enough at their jobs to cover the cost of childcare, and so it stops making sense for them to work.
So economically, women are forced into a kind of Hobson's choice that their job isn't going to do them any good, even if they want to be a contributing member of the household if they happen to be married or with a partner. And in the case of low-income women, if they do leave the workforce, it's kind of a one-way street. They don't get to go back.
It's very difficult to go back. That's another thing about the American economy right now is that anybody who leaves, if you're out for any period of time, you know, more than a year, you lose so many skills, you become very difficult to hire. And that's what a lot of the women that I spoke to said, is that they'd like to go back to work when their kids are in school and when childcare does not become such an issue anymore, but they just don't know if they can get hired. And one woman I spoke to in Southern California, I think really exemplifies the problem here. The problem is, of course, not people who voluntarily want to be out of the workforce, who want to be stay-at-home moms. That's great if they can do it. The problem is when people want to work. And this woman, she has two children. She lives in Southern California. She's a single parent. She loves to work. She wants to be able to support her family. She doesn't want to depend on anyone else. But she literally said she can't do it because she has no childcare. The jobs that she can get do not afford her childcare. When she was having morning sickness during her pregnancy, her office didn't, her workplace, which was a restaurant, didn't offer her sick leave. And so she had no choice but to quit.
Claire Kane Miller is a reporter for the New York Times Upshot in the San Francisco Bureau. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nearly 200 years ago, Austrian priest Joseph Mohr wanted to find a Christmas carol he could play on his guitar. So he wrote a lyric, got together with local school teacher and organist Franz Gruber, and came up with Stille Nacht, Silent Night, performed for the first time ever at a quiet midnight mass at St. Nicholas Church in Oberndorf, Austria in 1818. It was said to be a highlight of the Christmas season, but Gruber remembered Silent Night as a simple, undistinguished melody. History would have other ideas. Silent Night was one of the most recognized Christmas carols by the end of the 19th century, a popularity that has only increased. John Schaefer, host of WNYC's Soundcheck, says Silent Night is one of the most recorded Christmas carols of all time. How many covers of Silent Night have there been?
Over 700 in the last couple of years alone. We have everything from reggae versions to big honkin' orchestral full chorus versions. I mean, there's been a lot of gilding of this particular lily over the years.
So what are your favorite versions?
Well, in the UK, the favorite version seems to be the Irish singer Sinead O'Connor, who, as we know, has had a somewhat troublesome relationship with religion and the Catholic Church in general, but loves this song and did a version where she kind of strips away most of the accompaniment and just sings it over a drone, and it's really quite unusual.
Silent night, holy night, all is calm we see.
When was that originally recorded?
That's just a couple of years old, but it is the number one version in the UK. That is Sinead O'Connor. And you can see it's she's going for something very stark and simple. So to that extent, it's true to the original first performance of the hymn, of the carol.
Operatic versions, classical versions?
Oh, my God. They're just every year another dozen sopranos and baritones and tenors line up with their orchestras to sing this song. Which is why the Kathleen Battle recording kind of sticks out to me, because here's a great soprano performing without an orchestra with the renowned classical guitarist Christopher Parkening mm-hmm. as the only accompaniment.
What going to be something to have someone show up at your doorstep doing that version.
Yeah, I guess if you got the chops, you're going to show them off.
Yeah. And you wouldn't be doing it on the street, that's for sure.
Right.
Popular recordings. And Sinead's certainly a popular recording.
Absolutely, yeah. But, you know, the Minnesota husband and wife indie rock team known as Low does a version of Silent Night, which gets pretty close to what I imagine that first performance sounds like, because it is just two voices accompanied by an acoustic guitar. It's a very kind of pastoral, restrained version, and I think actually quite touching from this group called Low.
Christ the Savior is.
You know, there's a little twang to the harmonies there, you know, which is makes it very American sounding.
Speaking of American, you got a Motown version?
Oh, my gosh. What can you say about Al Green that hasn't been said many, many times before? But listen to his version of Silent Night.
The Reverend Al Green.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the sound of a man trying desperately and unsuccessfully to not be sexy. I mean, it's Silent Night, but he just can't help himself. There is such a kind of smooth R&B groove and a little late-night dimming of the lights there. It's a really fun version.
And, of course, someone who never tries to be unsexy, we can go out on.
Well, you know, Nick Lowe, the English pub rocker who had a bunch of hits in the 70s and who is still going strong, sort of takes Silent Night as this kind of blank slate to do with what he will. And what he wants to do with it is turn it into a hard-charging, upbeat pub rock anthem.
Silent. Shepherds quay at the side. In that stable there, kings from afar, wise men singing hallelujah. Christ the Savior is born.
You know, this is not, you know, let's all be very quiet and still on this holy night. This is Christmas Eve. Let's have a party.
John Schaefer, happy holidays. Thanks
happy
so much.
Happy holidays to you, John.
Round young virgin, mother and child, holy infant soul, tender and mild.
Hey, give us your version of Silent Night. Give us your rendition on 877-8-MY-TAKE, if you like. We love your risk-taking. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, you can always check us out at thetakeaway.org. Tonight marks the first night of Hanukkah, the 8-day festival of lights. We want to wish everyone celebrating a very happy Hanukkah. And regardless of what you're celebrating this holiday season, if anything at all, we want to hear about your holiday traditions. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.